say that there was no intelligence indicating the attack was imminent. For NPR News, I'm Elliot Hannon in New Delhi.
Federal regulators are proposing new rules to make it easier for people to fight what's known as cramming, the adding of unauthorized fees to phone bills, fees with labels such as voicemail hosting charge. Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia says the practice has been a moneymaker for the industry.
We estimate there have been about $10 billion worth of third-party charges on consumer telephone bills. We estimate that AT&T and Quest and Verizon have earned more than $650 million, those three companies, from this themselves.
Rockefeller's Senate panel is holding a hearing on the matter today. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com. With tools to monitor and protect the online reputations of doctors, lawyers, and business professionals, learn more at Reputation.com.
Today's programs are made possible by Champagne Cycle, 506 South Country Fair Drive in Champaign. Champagne Cycle believes that bicycle use can play a role in making this a better world by decreasing pollution, reducing obesity, relieving traffic congestion, lessening dependence on foreign oil, and increasing personal fitness.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Last April, an explosion at the Upper Big Branch coal mine in West Virginia killed 29 miners. It was the most deadly mine disaster in the United States in 40 years. A report on the event was commissioned by the former governor and was released in May and concluded that both the mine operator, Massey Energy, and the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration shared blame for this event. Overall, it was the conclusion of this panel that this was a preventable event. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the Upper Big Branch mine, what happened there last April, about the conclusions that have been drawn as people have looked into the cause, and we'll talk generally about mine safety and how that can be improved. And our guest for the program is Celeste Monfortin. She's a professional lecturer in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Science at the George Washington University Medical College. And in her research, she's interested in a number of things, including mine worker health and safety, and also occupational health risk assessment. Before becoming an academic, she worked in the Labor Department. She was a legislative analyst at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and also worked at the Mine Safety and Health Administration, where she was a policy advisor and chief of staff to the assistant secretary. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. We hope people will be brief just so we can accommodate as many callers as possible and be on the topic. Questions, however, are welcome. 333-9455, that is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, your questions are welcome. And Dr. Monfortin, hello.
David, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. This is an event certainly that got a lot of coverage when it occurred in the spring of 2010 and periodically has been in the news again. And recently, when this report was issued by this panel that you were a part of. So we definitely want to talk about that. But perhaps for people who don't follow the mining industry, we should refresh their memory and just tell us what happened there at the Upper Big Branch Mine, April 5th of 2010.
April 5th was Easter Monday, so the mine had been shut down over the Easter holiday. Typically, there are about 90 coal miners there at the mine, like there were on that Monday morning. Most of the miners just reported that it seemed like every other day there at the mine. The mine is a large sprawling complex. There were four mining sections operating, including what I like to call the money maker, which is the longwall mining part of the operation. And what we learned from our investigation was at about 3 o'clock on that Monday morning, there was a massive explosion in the mine. It was the time of the shift change, so there were some miners coming out of the mine at that time and others preparing to go underground. And those witnesses, which we were able to interview, reported on the massive blast. Some described it like sitting in the middle of a hurricane. Some of your listeners will recall that early in the rescue effort, there were 7 men who were removed from the mine immediately. They had died about a mile from the explosion, but still deep underground. And those were the 7 initial victims. And then as the rescue efforts went on, by about midnight, we learned that there were still 22 men who were missing or unaccounted for, and rescue teams from around the region went to the mine and tried to rescue or recover the other men inside the mine. It took 4 or 5 days before all of those men were accounted for, but because of dangerous conditions in the mine, all of the bodies were not removed until a week later. So there was a long vigil with family members waiting for the bodies of the men to be removed. So it went on for, you know, a week-long period, the recovery and rescue efforts, and then shortly after that is when the different appointed teams of investigators began their work.
Mm-hmm. Now, the company, Massey Energy, they said that they believe that the explosion was the result of a giant burst of methane gas, which is a problem in mines, that it somehow, there was a crack in the floor of the mine, a large amount of methane got in there, and that exploded. Now, go ahead.
So, you know, that's something, when we went in with our investigation, which we were appointed by the governor of West Virginia, we went in without any preconceived notions about what the cause of the actual blast was, and you have to just follow the physical evidence. So, we looked at that, and in our report, we describe the footprint of the disaster, and you can actually use the physical evidence inside the mine, looking at where the coal was singed, the extent of destruction in the mine. We looked at this elusive crack that Massey Energy said was the cause of the explosion. In our assessment of all of that physical evidence, we didn't find any credibility or any physical evidence to support the assertion that it was a massive inundation of natural gas that could not have been prevented. In fact, we describe in our report that the level of the amount of methane gas that would have been required to cause such a massive blast, including killing men who are more than a mile and a half away from the blast, would have been in the millions of cubic feet. And so that just it's not a plausible explanation.
So your conclusion, rather, was that the thing that caused this was an excessive buildup of coal dust, which, of course, is also a serious problem in mining, and it's something that you have to deal with because it's quite combustible.
Absolutely. And what you will, when talking with old-time miners and, you know, newly trained miners, they all know that what you need in a coal mine is good ventilation, and you need to control the coal dust. And the footprint of this disaster shows a classic example of a spark that was ignited from one of the cutting machines on the longwall. That spark ignited a pocket of methane gas, which is a naturally occurring in a coal mine. That spark then was fueled by excessive amounts of coal dust that were throughout the mine. The mine operator had a completely inadequate program to control the coal dust and damp it down with incombustible rock dust, and so it just, the explosion was really not one explosion, but a series of explosions that ran like lines of gunpowder through the mine and killed way, way too many coal miners. Mm.
So in fact, methane perhaps did play a small role here, but it wasn't methane exclusively, and certainly there wasn't so much methane to cause the degree of damage, the size of the explosion that you could clearly see.
David, that's exactly correct. So what we know in coal mines is that methane is a natural byproduct of the coal, and you have an effective ventilation system to sweep away that methane because it is highly explosive, and you are using mechanical equipment. And we know with mechanical equipment you can have two pieces that rub together and create a spark. You can have a piece of metal that hits a piece of rock and creates a spark, just like you would, you know, as a kid you might do that in your backyard trying to create a spark. And so if you have an operation that can create a spark and you have a natural occurring gas that can fuel that spark, you need a really effective ventilation system to sweep away that gas so that the spark does not lead to a larger explosion. Mm. The other thing that occurred at this mine, because it was the holiday weekend, we had evidence that the evidence before the explosion was this mine had a very precarious ventilation system and many, many violations of not following properly their ventilation system. And on the weekend, which was Easter weekend, there was evidence that some of the water pumps that helped to keep the water out of the mine tunnels actually failed. And if you can imagine a tunnel that is supposed to help move the air, and you want that air to be moving so it's sweeping away that methane gas, but if you imagine a tunnel that is slowly filling with water, you can envision how the air is not going to flow properly. And the evidence was that some of these water pumps failed over the holiday weekend. And so when the men returned to work on Monday, the air was not flowing properly, and so you had even, a precarious ventilation system that was made worse because of buildup of water. And so when this spark occurred the ventilation system wasn't working properly, it caused the initial blast that was then fueled by the coal dust.
Mm. And apparently there had been problems or at least complaints by miners about lack of air in the mine for a long time, that would contribute significantly to people's exhaustion, that they weren't getting enough air when they were working underground, and that there are also reports that when people complained about this, they were threatened with being fired.
Absolutely. There was extremely troubling testimony that we heard from the experienced miners there that they did not have enough air. There was one miner who would say, you know, if you're going to work up on that section, bring your own air. And that was something that was well known. There were miners who spoke to management about it. Some of the men who died in the mine spoke to management and raised complaints about that to management within weeks and months before the explosion. And so that was confirmed by witnesses that the problems with inadequate ventilation were well known both to the miners and that they raised these complaints to management there at the mine. Mm-hmm.
Let me just introduce very quickly again our guest for this hour, Dr. Celeste Monfort, and she's a professional lecturer in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Science at the George Washington University Medical College, and among other things is interested in mine worker health and safety. She was a member of a commission that was appointed by the former governor of West Virginia, Joe Manchin, to look into the causes of the explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine. This was in April of 2010. The commission just released the results of its efforts in May of this year, and that's what we're talking about. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And, of course, we also have a possibility for email if you're interested in expressing your thoughts that way, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu.
David, you mentioned that you had read and were aware that there were miners who complained about this situation with the air. And again, there was some compelling testimony from one miner who was a section boss. He was up on one of the sections with his men, realized the air was not adequate for them to run coal, which is, you know, what they say when they're ready to put the machine in the coal and start extracting it. And he and his men worked for about an hour to get the air right, which is how they describe it, to get the ventilation correct. The next day when he reported to work, he was suspended for several days because of what they called poor work performance. And what we were all appalled, I mean, that's not poor work performance. He was doing exactly as he should have done, protecting the miners there and making sure the ventilation was correct. So, I mean, that was a very concrete example of an individual there at the mine who recognized the problem, wanted to do the right thing, and management took adverse action against him.
Mm-hmm. Going back to talk a little bit about the problem of coal dust, and as you explained, the finding of the panel that you were a part of was that there was something, that the equipment that was being used in the mining operations caused a spark. There was a pocket of methane that was ignited, and that then ignited a much larger explosion or series of explosions because there was a serious problem of coal dust, and they weren't doing the mitigation that they should have been doing. I think that you would say, probably people who looked at this would say, that the methods for controlling coal dust in mine are certainly well established. It's not that difficult, or at least people know how to do it, and that if the company had actually been doing that, this wouldn't have happened.
Absolutely. It's very fundamental, and any old-time coal miner will tell you, you need air and water and rock dust. It's not rocket science, but you do have to be diligent about it. You do have to have enough personnel dedicated to being responsible for maintaining the equipment and laying down the rock dust.
Well, maybe you can explain now, and I have read just at least a little bit about this, that the technique for controlling the coal dust is something called rock dusting. What is that exactly?
Correct. That's something that's been known for not quite a century, but you take limestone and crush it up, pulverize it, and spread it throughout the mine on both the sides, which we call the ribs and the roof, and all along your belt lines, and it's a white stone. And when that limestone dust is mixed with the coal dust or covering the coal dust, it makes the coal dust inexplosive. So it's a way to temper the explosibility of the coal dust. And there were some coal miners, some of the older ones in particular, when we'd ask them about rock dust, they would say things like, a white mine is a happy mine, or could never have enough rock dust in a mine. I mean, that was something that would bring a smile to their face when they would talk about rock dust as a way to really prevent explosions. And it's something that, like I said, it's not rocket science to have a crew of miners responsible for distributing the rock dust through the mine.
And it was apparently the finding of this panel that you were a part of, that not only were there not enough miners involved in doing dust control, but that the machinery that they were using often was not working properly.
Right. It was really, I mean, just appalling when you think about a major corporation like Massey Energy using a piece of rock dusting equipment, which they called the pod duster, that was more than 25 years old. And the best research we could do by getting back to the manufacturer was this was probably a piece of equipment that the mine, that Massey inherited when they purchased this mine in 1994 from Peabody Energy. And for people interested, I think you have a link to our report on your website. There's a photo of this pod duster. Mm-hmm. the miners, the two men part-time work that they had for rock dusting, they would describe this piece of equipment as just an utter piece of junk. It wouldn't stay on the track. The hoses would get clogged. It just made it impossible for them to do their jobs effectively. And you could tell from their interviews that they were extremely frustrated and frightened because they knew that what they were doing was so critical to the safety of their fellow workers, but they weren't given the equipment or the time or the extra help they needed to do this properly. So this is a big sprawling mine covering more than 3 miles. They have one piece of equipment that is very old and doesn't work properly. And then they had another piece of equipment that we found there at the mine that was basically just for scrap parts. So for us, I mean, it was this real paradox where you have a mine operator with a $50 million piece of equipment in the mine, and yet they wouldn't even invest in a decent piece of equipment and enough crew to protect the mine workers there.
Well, this brings us perhaps to the question of talking about the conduct of the mine operator, Massey Energy. Was it the conclusion that the company knew what would be involved in running a safe mine? They were aware of conditions in the mine, and that they were not following established safety procedures, and that was something that within the administration and the management of the company that they knew they were not following established safety procedures. Celeste?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, David, you're absolutely right. In my opinion, this company knew what those procedures were. They know how to operate a safe mine. They knew what the conditions were in the mine and at the grave risk that they were putting their workers in, and they elected not to take those steps.
Mm-hmm. And is there actually a record that could be established that indeed the people running the company were aware of that fact and that they were disregarding established safety procedures?
There are hundreds of pages of documents that demonstrate that. If we had an opportunity to look at many of those documents, and those are things that are prepared, those are documents that are prepared by the section foreman, by the fire bosses, where they would be recording the hazards. One piece of information that we pulled together, just to give your listeners an example, in the March to April period, immediately before the explosion, the miners who were responsible for examining the mine and looking for hazards recorded on these reports that were given to management, and they're done every day, that there were 561 times in the month before the explosion, 561 times when these examiners noted that there needs to be more rock dust. There needs to be more rock dust. And those records show that only 65 times was more rock dust actually applied. So only 11% of the times did management do anything based on the information provided by men in the mine that this hazard was there. So those are that's the type of evidence that we have that tells me that this company knew exactly what was going on in the mine and chose not to take the steps needed to prevent the explosion.
Mm. Well, certainly the report that you were involved in was very strongly critical of the company, of Massey. And I think actually there were some people who were maybe a little bit surprised at how strongly worded your report was.
That's true. We did have some reporters and some lawmakers were given pause by the strong language we used. But I think when you have a disaster of this magnitude, the worst coal mine disaster in 40 years that kills 29 workers, you can't help but just lay the facts out there. And we had, you know, the benefit of having that information and looking at it, and in our opinion, I mean, this was something that was completely preventable, and the company failed to take the steps it needed to do to prevent it.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, to be fair here, we also should make sure we'll talk about the conclusions that you've drawn about the job that the Mine Safety and Health Administration was doing, because in your report you have concluded that in fact both the mine operator was at fault for not following, as we said, not following established procedures about operating a safe mine, but that also that you feel that the government was at fault for not enforcing the existing rules, and that perhaps has something to do with the procedures that are in place for citing companies and how that has to be appealed and so forth and so on. But I guess one basic question would be, did the Mine Safety and Health Administration people, were they fully aware of conditions in the mine, and did they have all of that information available to them so that they could get a good picture of what was going on?
As we outline in the report, I mean, you can't have a disaster of this magnitude without also looking at the performance of the agency that is responsible for being that watchdog for the mine, for the mine workers. And when we looked back, and again, you know, I mean, it's kind of like Monday morning quarterbacking, but when we looked back at the record, we identified a number of failures by the agency to really use all the enforcement authority at its disposal. In talking with the frontline inspectors that were in that mine, we learned from them that through their inspection process, I mean, they really were overwhelmed by the magnitude of the hazards there, and also the system where, as you mentioned, David, you know, you can issue a citation against an operator, but they have the opportunity to appeal it, and so you get into this back and forth through the litigation process, but nothing actually changes the behavior of the operation. So when you have an operation like this one at Upper Big Branch, where they have hundreds and hundreds of violations, and they fix the immediate hazard, but it just pops up again the next day, you know, the same thing just in a different part of the mine, you're not really changing the behavior there at the mine. And one of the tools that was at MSHA's disposal, but it failed to use, was something called a flagrant violation, which really has to do with repeated bad performance. And this flagrant tool that MSHA had was something that was put in the statute after the Sago disaster, that lawmakers felt there really needed to be another tool for MSHA, a stronger tool. So when you have recalcitrant mine operators, that you really can, you know, sock them with something other than just a regular citation. And so it was extremely regrettable when we looked at the records and learned that MSHA had never issued a flagrant violation against Upper Big Branch, in particular in the 6 months leading up to the disaster, where these really atrocious conditions and violations of their own ventilation plan were found by mine inspectors.
Yeah. So sort of my understanding of what we're talking about here is the potential of a very large fine if companies repeatedly fail to address violations that might lead to death or injury of workers, and that, in fact, MSHA had done this other places more than 125 times at other places in the last few years, but never at Upper Big Branch.
Absolutely. The penalties could be up to $220,000, which we think would have sent a really big signal, rather than just, you know, a $1,000 citation here or $400 citation there, to just, you know, use that tool and send the signal. And also, I believe, I mean, it would have sent given information to the miners that these are not just run-of-the-mill, you know, violations, that this has gotten the attention of the agency, and the agency calls this a repeated violation. I think the miners themselves would have been, you know, that would have given them even more information that things are not right at this mine.
Yeah. Also, it was my understanding that MSHA has the ability to sanction companies that have repeated violations. What they can do is they can list them in a category of pattern of violations, and after that, if they find a serious violation, That would actually mean that in that part of the mine, the miners would have to leave. They'd have to evacuate the workers until they fixed the problem. And that was something that MSHA had that authority for some time, but this year, it had used it actually for the first time. Is that right?
Absolutely. This is something that has been in the statute since 1969 and had never been used by the agency. So it's not just something that, you know, we can look at in the context of Upper Big Branch, but it was something that when Upper Big Branch occurred, people said, you know, why wouldn't MSHA shut down this mine? And you start to look and you say, wow, they have this tool, but they never used it. And you're absolutely correct that it wasn't until after Upper Big Branch that MSHA used that tool for the first time. Just this year in April, it issued two of these pattern of violation notices to two mine operators.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with Dr. Celeste Monfortin, and we're talking about the disaster at the Upper Big Branch mine that happened last April, that is April of 2010. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with different topics every week. Tomorrow, in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, we'll be talking with Hunter Lovins, co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute, and we'll talk about a book that she's involved in writing, Climate Capitalism, Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change, taking a look at the argument that says being green actually can be good for the economy. That's tomorrow morning at 10. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, we will talk about Afghanistan with Peter Thompson. He was a former special envoy to the Afghan Mujahideen. He had the rank of ambassador during the Bush administration, also served as ambassador to the Republic of Armenia in the late 90s. And we'll be talking about a book that he's written that looks at what has happened in Afghanistan in the last few years. Also in the second hour today, we'll talk about fracking, something that's getting a lot of attention in the news. It's a method of extracting natural gas, and some people think that by doing that, we can really increase domestic energy supplies. Other people are very worried about the potential environmental impact of this technique of extraction. We'll be talking with journalist Seamus McGraw about his book, The End of Country. That's in the second hour today. You can find out what we're doing by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Dr. Celeste Monfortin. She's a professional lecturer in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Science at the George Washington Medical College. In her academic work, she's interested in a number of things, including occupational health risk assessment and mine worker health and safety. And she was a member of a commission that was appointed by the former governor of West Virginia, Joe Manchin, to look into the causes of this explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine that took place in April of 2010. They just released the results of their findings in May of this year, and we're talking about that this morning. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you could also send us an email if you would like to communicate that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here, so we'll bring them into the conversation. They're here in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. This is a good topic, and this sort of thing needs to be done repeatedly. But I would suggest a comment about what happens when we change presidents, when we have elections. Because what I've observed, and that's been about 40 years doing geology and coal in Illinois, whether it's a governor or whether it's a president, or their lieutenants, they're the ones who make high-level appointments in bureaus. That what's left usually, if you want to undermine regulation, you do what the Chamber of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce does and talk continually about oppressive regulation. Then you appoint your own men and women to regulatory heads as regulatory heads. And what goes on then is what happened in the late 70s, early 80s, when Illinois was adapting its mining regulations to the new federal regulations. Reagan took office. The heads of these district offices changed. This doesn't have so much to do with safety as the conduct of mining to conserve resources and land. And district offices began to close. And all at once, there was very little interest on a state level or on a federal level with talking to coal geologists and writing stricter regulations. And this is what I see that makes Illinois EPA toothless. A lot of well-intentioned but inexperienced junior people doing inspections, answering complaints, writing reports. A bunch of intermediate time servers, and then at the top, people who are not going to embarrass their godfather. So having said that, I'll listen for your comment. Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Mumfortin, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with your commenter's views, and it occurs at both the federal and state level. Elections do matter, and as he indicated, you know, the president or the governor, they appoint individuals to be in these regulatory agencies. And if you just look at, you know, the Mine Safety Agency, there were a lot of pullback on regulations, more interest in what we call compliance assistance rather than enforcement. And even though this disaster occurred during the Obama administration, one might try to assess whether this disaster itself was really a latency effect of the anti-regulatory rollbacks during the George Bush administration. I also agree with your caller that there is a tremendous amount of very damaging rhetoric about oppressive regulations, job-killing regulations. And I believe that the more lawmakers and the public use those terms, the more people start to believe it when it's not actually based in truth. Let me give one example related to Upper Big Branch. Some of your listeners may have heard the news reports that following the disaster, the victims, the 29 men, had autopsies, and 24 of the men had enough lung tissue to be examined to determine whether they have black lung disease. And this is something that is a quote-unquote regulation, and some people might say it's oppressive, but I would argue that in 2012 in the United States of America, our coal miners should not be developing black lung disease. And what the autopsies show, that of the 24 men who had enough lung tissue to be analyzed, 71% of them, 17 of them had black lung disease, and those were not just among the older miners. The age range for those black lung victims was 25-year-old all the way up to a 61-year-old. Some of those men, the only place they worked was Upper Big Branch. And there are there is an initiative going on at the Mine Safety Agency right now to improve protections, to issue a regulation on black lung. And we hear a lot of rhetoric, including from representatives from Illinois and the mining regions of Indiana, talking about how these, you know, regulations are going to hurt jobs. But without these regulations, we end up with coal miners who have black lung disease.
You know, this was I'm glad you got to this point, because this was something that I wanted to ask you about, and that there was this finding that you mentioned, and the limits on coal dust that apparently have been in place since the early 70s were supposed to help prevent this, and clearly have not. Though, is there reason to think that at Upper Big Branch this would have been worse than at other places? So this is just an Upper Big Branch kind of a problem, or is there reason to think that across the country, in different mines, different miners working in different places, if we could conduct the same kind of test, we would come up with the same result?
Right. Well, what the epidemiology tells us is that the current exposure limit for 2 milligrams is not protective of minors' health, and that's something that's been known since at least the mid-1990s, that if you follow minors over the course of their careers, you will find that those who are exposed to 2 milligrams, there is an excess risk of developing black lung. And so what the epidemiology also tells us that if that exposure limit were reduced to 1 milligram, we would have many fewer cases of black lung disease. So what the enforcement data tells us that many mine operators are already complying with something near a 1 milligram limit. So that's half of what the law requires. But for those minors that are exposed to 2 milligrams or more, that they are at serious risk of developing black lung.
Something else I wanted to ask you about in the disaster at Upper Big Branch, for several hours after the explosion, there was a lot of confusion about who was in the mine. And back in 2006, I believe it is, that mine companies were required to put in electronic monitoring systems so they would know where the miners were in the mine. And in fact, at Upper Big Branch, they were working on such a system, but it was still in process of being installed, and it was a long way from being complete and operational. And it seems to me that the technology here is not particularly sophisticated, although there may be some difficulties involved in doing this where people are underground like that. What's that would seem like a pretty simple thing to be able to keep track of where miners are. What sort of problems are involved in that, and how well are other mine operators doing in having systems like that in place?
David, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's nothing more fundamental than knowing how many miners are underground, and better yet, knowing where they're located. And it was really appalling to look through the reports from the rescue operation and to find out that it wasn't until about 9 hours after the explosion did the company really have a handle on how many men were underground, that they knew that they needed to find 22 more men. In the old days, you know, what miners would have is you would have this tagging system, a little brass tag, and if you were underground, you'd move the brass tag to one part of the bulletin board, and once you were back on the surface, you move it back to the other side, and that's how they would keep track of who was underground. You're absolutely correct that after the Sago disaster, we not only wanted to know who was underground, but where better information about where they were located. And so in June of 2006, the law was passed, and there were requirements that mine operators put in more sophisticated electronic tracking systems. And so over the course of the last four to five years, operators have been installing those systems. There are some technological challenges, but not ones that I think can't be overcome with American ingenuity. But the way the system is supposed to work is while you are installing those and until it is fully operational, you need to have a backup plan. And for me, if I was running a mine and I was doing the installation and I was working on getting my electronic tracking, until that system was up and running, I would keep a brass tag or some other system in place so that if there were a disaster of some sort, I would know who at least was underground. Mm-hmm. And they did not have such a system in place at Upper Big Branch. And it was really very, very compelling to hear from the family members who for hours and hours would wait, and the company couldn't even tell them whether it was their loved one that was underground.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me again just introduce quickly the guest, Dr. Celeste Monforton from the George Washington University Medical College. She was a member of a commission that was appointed by the former governor of West Virginia, Joe Manchin, to look into the causes of the Upper Big Branch mine explosion in April 2010. They just put out their report in May 2011, and they said that both the mine operator, Massey Energy, and the federal government were responsible, the mine operator, for not following established safety rules, and then the federal government for not really seeing that those rules were followed and enforced. The report is available online if you want to take a look at it. Questions and comments certainly are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Going back to the questions about MSHA and whether or not it's doing its job. To inspect a mine, you've got to send people there. People have to go into the mine. They have to look around. And then after that, as we've said, there are some questions about the process and how long it takes and how cumbersome it is. But just if you ask the question, well, are there enough mine inspectors, people available to do the work? Are there enough?
Well, because the mine statute requires mandatory inspection, so Congress put in the law that there have to be at least 4 inspections a year at underground coal mines, there is an obligation by Congress to actually fund the agency so it can accomplish its statutory mission. So when I look at MSHA's budget and allocations for numbers of mine inspectors, they have the personnel needed to do that job, where if you look at an agency like OSHA, they have so few inspectors for the 9 million workplaces around the country, but there also isn't anything in their statute that actually obligates them to do inspections at workplaces. So, the basic answer to your question is yes, MSHA has the personnel to do the job. The larger question is do they use those personnel in the right way and focus their activities in a way that makes the most sense and gets the best bang for the buck.
Yeah. Well, what about the process of siting mines? As we have explained, there seems to be this problem that you can send an inspector in the mine and the inspector sees a problem. And the inspector writes up the mine operator and hands that over to them. And then the mine operator can say, well, you know, we're not really sure this is quite correct or accurate. And so there's a lot of this. It could be a long back and forth going on before you ever get some resolution. And then you have this issue of mine operators that pile up big stacks of violations, and somehow they just go on and on. And so you get people building up this great backload of violations without seemingly anything being done. Is there some way that process could be expedited, first of all, and then really you so that also that you don't have mine operators having repeatedly being cited for violations and nothing is done?
Right. That system has to change, or we're not doing what we need to do to protect coal miners. When an inspector issues a citation, sees a hazard in a mine, the operator is required to fix it as quickly as possible. It might be fixing it at that exact moment, or it might take a couple hours, or it might be something more complicated that would take a little more time. But there is a requirement in the statute that hazard is corrected immediately. But also, the operator does have this opportunity to challenge that inspector's findings, and in particular, challenge both the classification, whether it was a serious or an egregious type violation, and also challenge the dollar amount that goes along with that penalty. And as you were describing, David, what happens in this country at far too many mining operations is that there are mine operators who, yes, they'll fix the hazard, but they keep getting the same cited for the same hazard over and over again, and there's no learning of the lesson. There's no integrating of behavior change. And so we're getting into this administrative battle that is a huge resource drain. And it also sends this message to inspectors that, you know, yeah, they're going to fix it here at this moment in time, but I'm going to walk down to this other section in the mine, and the same problem is going to be there, and why am I wasting my time? So, I mean, it's really demoralizing, not only for the inspector, but for the workers that are there employed. It's like they don't even care enough about me to fix this problem, which is a well-known and recognized hazard. So that part of the system, kind of this gamesmanship that goes on, that's something that really needs to be changed. And I would recommend something like, if you have a mine operator, something basic like not doing their rock dusting, which is, you know, so fundamental. And you can set up some metric that says, you know, you have to be able to have a quarter inch of rock dust throughout this mine, and you take a ruler and they don't have it, you shut the mine down. I mean, you're just not allowed to operate any longer until you do something fundamental to change that behavior so it doesn't happen again. And when you start hitting mine operators in their pocket, when they have to stop running coal and not producing the coal, which is how they generate profit, they will change their behavior.
Well, and would that be something that Congress ultimately would have to do it? Is it the Congress that writes regulations, or is it the federal government that writes regulations, and then the Congress is responsible for making sure that regulations are enforced? How exactly does that work?
Well, the way I would see it, I'm not a lawyer, but I look at the statute. When I see something like the pattern of violation, MSHA could write an interpretation, which would be a regulation that says this is how we're going to interpret it. You know, there is a great desire to make things in Washington, to make things overly complicated, and I'd like to do something like they've done with the drug laws. You know, three strikes, you're out. Three strikes of not having, you know, enough rock dust, you're out. You're out of the picture. And I know that I wouldn't get a lot of support from the National Mining Association or coal operators, but I just think we need to get tough with this because it's inexcusable in the United States of America for 29 coal miners to die on the job.
Yeah. Well, that's it's and we certainly should remember that and remember them, and that is the terribly sad aspect of here. 29 people died. It was the worst mine accident in this country since 1970, and invariably as these things go, you know, we have a big accident like that, and then it focuses attention on the issue. And we talk about
exactly.
that for a while, and we have commissions, and people issue reports, and then you go on. So I think then you have to ask this question, well, now more than a year after this sad event where all these people lost their lives, are miners today in the United States any more safe than they were in April of last year?
I don't see anything that has changed fundamentally in the United States to say that miners are safer today than they were a year ago. And that's really regrettable. As you mentioned, there has been no changes in the law. It's been a year since the disaster. And I've talked with a number of the family members who lost loved ones there at the mine. And some of them are eager to go to Washington, D.C. and talk to lawmakers and insist, you know, that something be done so that their loved ones didn't die in vain.
Hmm. And is something like that going to happen? Are there people interested in Congress in pushing this issue?
Well, I think both the senators from West Virginia, Senator Manchin and Senator Rockefeller, have introduced a bill in the Senate that would address some of the problems that were identified at Upper Big Branch. The Senate, you know, all of Congress is focused right now on the budget and the debt ceiling, but I would certainly hope that, you know, come September, that we can really make a push to try to see some fundamental changes so that those men at Upper Big Branch didn't die in vain.
Mm. Oh, so it's your former governor, the guy who appointed you to this commission, he's now the senator.
Correct.
Is that the same?
Correct.
That's the same Joe Manchin.
That is Joe Manchin, right. He was the governor at the time of Upper Big Branch, and then shortly after Upper Big Branch, at the beginning of June, Senator Robert Byrd died, and there was a special election, and Governor Manchin ran for that seat, and he is now Senator Manchin.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. Again, I'll mention to people, if they'd like to read the report, this report to the governor of West Virginia from this panel that had been appointed by the former governor, Joe Manchin, it is available online, and you can take a look at that, his report on the Upper Big Branch explosion, April 5th of 2010. Our guest in this hour, Dr. Celeste Monfortin. She is a professional lecturer in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Science at the George Washington University Medical College. And among other things, she's interested in occupational health risk assessment and mine worker health and safety. And Dr. Monfortin, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thank you so much for inviting me. It was a real pleasure.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn offers programs designed to support residents' health and independence and to help them feel secure in their environment. More information is available at 384-0100.
In the next part of Focus, we'll be talking with journalist Seamus McGraw about his new book, End of Country. It's about some of the potential environmental consequences of exploring for and developing natural gas resources in this country. More on that in a little bit. First, though, an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
And with this update on the markets, Jay Pierce at 10:59. Well, the wheat and corn prices that shot up yesterday, giving back some of their big gains that were partially fueled by the hot weather concerns for the U.S. Corn Belt. Soybeans firm on concerns about some weather damage to the U.S. Crop and also export sales levels that came in slightly higher than expected. The hard red winter wheat for July in Kansas City down two now. At 7:39, September 7:56, down 6. July wheat in Chicago at 688.5, down 13.5. And September at 695.75, down 18.75. December 724.75, down 17.25. July corn 720.25, down 6.5. September at 679.25, down 7.5. December at 669.75, down 10. The August crude oil at 96.56 continues its fall, down 150 now. It had been over $98 a barrel earlier today. July soybeans at 13.95 and a half, up 8.